Welcome to this RCGP podcast on functional gastrointestinal disorders. I'm Dr. Emma Nash, GP and e-learning fellow at the RCGP. Today I'll be talking to Professor Pally Hungin, who is Emeritus Professor of Primary Care and General Practice at Newcastle University and Chair of the Primary Care Committee of the Rome Foundation for the Functional Gastrointestinal Diseases. Pally's here to discuss the nature of functional GI disorders and how GPs might approach diagnosis and management. Thank you for joining us today, Pally.
Thank you very much, Emma. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
So, functional GI disorders, it's a term that not everyone will be familiar with. Could you give us an overview of what they are?
Yes, functional GI disorders is a bit of a misnomer in terms of the labelling. Essentially, the functional GI disorders are problems of the gastrointestinal tract, or at least symptoms and problems that appear to be coming from the gastrointestinal tract. But these are problems which have no organic basis. In other words, no anatomical abnormality, no clearly defined physiological or biochemical abnormality. These are problems that produce unpleasant symptoms, but for which there are no specific tests, investigations, or scans which will show any particular discernible abnormality in the usual sense. The word functional can be confusing because the implication is that this is to do with the function of the bodily system involved. But under most circumstances, there are no functional abnormalities per se either. So this can be a bit of a confusing term.
So how is this understanding of their existence developed, and how can it help us in primary care to recognize them?
I think throughout history, doctors have had to deal with patients with constellations of symptoms which cannot be easily explained in terms of an anatomical, physiological, or biochemical abnormality. More recently, we've started to categorize these as constellations of symptoms that emanate from a specific body system, so to speak. So, for example, irritable bowel syndrome is ascribed to the GI tract, but of course, there are problems that occur in many other parts of the body. The irritable bladder syndrome in the urogenital area, palpitations, which have been regarded quite often as being of functional origin. In the musculoskeletal system, fibromyalgia, nonspecific joint pains, these all form specific constellations. So almost every body system has its own set of symptoms for which there is no easy, straightforward explanation. A linking explanation more recently has been one which connects the central nervous system with the body. And a lot of these new functional problems are now being recategorized as disorders of brain body interaction, or in our case today, disorders of gut-brain interaction. There have been some advances in our recent understanding of the neurophysiology that links the central nervous system with the rest of the body, particularly in our instance with the gastrointestinal tract. We know that there is bidirectional signaling between the gut and the brain, and there are clear pathways now of neuronal and biochemical nature, leading to hypervigilance within the central nervous system, hypersensitivity within the GI tract. And these signaling mechanisms have an influence on how signals are perceived and acted upon. In some instances, in a simple way, hypervigilance is a hyper-awareness of pain, discomfort, or other unpleasant symptoms, and the brain begins to react to these even before the symptoms are perceived, leading to a sense of hypervigilance or over-awareness of what might happen. And this is one explanation for why symptoms in functional disorders are so difficult to manage when they're targeted at the gastrointestinal tract alone.
And you touched on some of the other conditions that are considered functional, or as you say, about brain-gut or brain-body dysfunction. As with many patients, conditions don't often present in isolation. So in addition to what we've just discussed, how might GPs go about recognising the conditions? And are there any particular contexts in which we might think it more likely?
Many general practitioners fear that they may miss an important diagnosis if they make a diagnosis of irritable bowel syndrome. It is important to make a positive diagnosis, but it is also important to ensure that we're not dealing with something like celiac disease, inflammatory bowel disease, which many clinicians are apprehensive about missing, and more recently, bile acid malabsorption, which can cause symptoms very similar to IBS with a great deal of diarrhea. Celiac disease can also present with diarrhea, with abdominal pain and discomfort, and a great deal of lethargy. These are symptoms which are quite common in many of our patients. And an easy way of ruling out, or at least thinking about and ruling out celiac disease, is to conduct a serological test. And the two commonest ones are, of course, the endomysial antibody test, or the more sensitive, more commonly done test, which is the TTG test. And these detect the levels of IgA in a blood sample. In terms of fecal calprotectin, this is a test which has been recommended by NICE for not so much ruling out, but delineating between irritable bowel syndrome and inflammatory bowel disease. Calprotectin is a chemical, a protein, which is produced from the cells within the body when there is an inflammatory reaction going on. And a fecal calprotectin test, which contains higher levels of calprotectin, can be indicative of inflammatory bowel disease rather than irritable bowel syndrome. But in many parts of the country, GPs are being encouraged to do a calprotectin test on their patients from a fecal specimen. And if the levels, as agreed at a local setting, are beyond a particular number, usually beyond 50 micrograms per gram, this might indicate that the patient has inflammatory bowel disease. And this, of course, will alter management and referral. And thirdly, quite importantly, patients who have a great deal of diarrhea, particularly urgent diarrhea, and many of whom may well have had a cholecystectomy, may be suffering from bile acid malabsorption. And this has become increasingly recognized, as up to half of patients who had a diagnosis of IBS-D may well have fallen into this category. And this can be investigated by doing what's known as a CHAT test. This is done within a laboratory, within a hospital setting usually, and this measures whether or not the fecal bile levels are being excreted and dealt with in the normal way. And I've found in my clinical practice that these three tests are quite reassuring in making sure that we're not missing something important. And I think that GPs are aware that these functional symptoms very rarely occur in isolation. So, for example, someone presenting with gastrointestinal symptoms will probably have symptoms which can be ascribed to more than one part of the GI tract. So not necessarily irritable bowel syndrome alone, but say IBS together with functional dyspepsia or gastroesophageal problems. At the same time, many patients will often have other difficulties which are of functional nature: muscle pains, joint pains, migraine, overall tiredness, and a whole constellation of symptoms for which there isn't often an easy explanation. One of the clues here might be that patients who present with these symptoms are often stressed and anxious. And although we know that depression per se does not cause these symptoms, there is an association between these symptoms as well as stress and anxiety. The functional gastrointestinal disorders include disorders all the way from the upper GI tract right down to the bottom. So these disorders include what was previously known as globus hystericus, has been now redefined. We're aware of esophageal functional syndromes, functional heartburn, for example. We've all had to deal with functional dyspepsia in patients in whom there is no abnormality. And of course, the commonest lower GI tract functional disorder is irritable bowel syndrome, although, of course, you can also get functional constipation as well as functional diarrhea.
Well, most GPs will be happy with the recognition and the basic management of irritable bowel syndrome, but the challenge comes when the usual treatments don't work. What would you recommend in this scenario?
I think it's important to be sure that one is dealing with a functional problem. If we're talking about irritable bowel syndrome, for example, we need to be able to rule out a number of other important conditions,
such as those we've already mentioned: celiac disease, bile acid malabsorption, and inflammatory bowel disease.
And also, we need to quite obviously be aware of other dangerous problems such as cancer, particularly GI cancer, but also ovarian problems, and more recently, as has been in the press, endometriosis. What I do need to stress is that IBS can coexist with inflammatory bowel disease. And one of our biggest problems, of course, is trying to distinguish between the two. And perhaps we can come back to that later, because there are ways of trying to work out whether a patient has irritable bowel syndrome, which is IBS, or inflammatory bowel disease, which is IBD. And this can be done through calprotectin testing. It's important to think of these concurrent problems, but the definition of irritable bowel syndrome and the recommendations for its diagnosis are that GPs should make a positive diagnosis based on the history. The history, of course, contains the common features which we're all familiar with: abdominal pain and discomfort, altered bowel habit, the absence of serious red flag symptoms and signs, and other symptoms that may be coexisting with GI symptoms. So it's important to make a positive diagnosis in order to set off on a positive dialogue with the patient. If we, for a moment, concentrate on irritable bowel syndrome, the standard treatment approach is to deal with the symptoms specifically. We know that irritable bowel syndrome is broadly split into three categories: IBS, which is constipation predominant, IBS, which is diarrhea predominant, and IBS, which is of mixed predominance with constipation and diarrhea. So symptom control is the usual approach in the first instance. And unfortunately, it's uncommon for a single therapy to be able to be successful in these situations. We've probably all used the usual medications, for example, fiber for irritable bowel syndrome. Fiber has to be handled carefully, of course, because insoluble fiber will expand within the bowel and make constipation and abdominal discomfort worse in some instances. Insoluble fiber may have a much better positive effect in some patients with irritable bowel syndrome. Beyond that, there are a number of other therapies from the point of view of medical interventions. The newer approaches using low-dose tricyclics is quite important. We're used to using antidepressant medications in general practice, but the tricyclics have become relatively less used. In general practice, low-dose tricyclics like amitriptyline, starting at a low dose of 10 milligrams, building up to 25 milligrams or higher, is often very effective in helping patients with IBS of any of the categories that we've mentioned. This, of course, requires a careful dialogue with the patient, because one is treating the IBS rather than saying that the patient has a psychological problem. Beyond that, there are a number of other new interventions. For example, the use of the FODMAP diet. The FODMAP diet is a diet which essentially excludes various types of sugars from the diet and can be used for both IBS, constipation, and diarrhea predominance. The word FODMAP stands for fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. A bit of a mouthful, but there are diet sheets available, and the reduction of food products containing these items over a period of time will produce evidence as to whether the patient may be sensitive to them. So this has become part of the management. After that, there are a number of newer therapies being developed, but they're not particularly easily or directly available to general practice. From the non-therapy, non-drug viewpoint, the psychological side of things has become quite important recently. There is a new field which has developed, gastropsychology, and a great deal of work has gone into gut-directed CBT, cognitive behavior therapy, which has been shown to be positively associated with good outcomes. Also gut-directed hypnotherapy, if you and your patients can manage to find practitioners locally. And there are other techniques being developed in addition to relaxation techniques and in some instances, biofeedback as well. What this points to is that we're dealing with a constellation of symptoms, which is very much a holistic issue for both the patient and the clinician. So I think we just need to watch this space to see what else comes along. But I think I've mentioned the main interventions that are being used at the moment.
Well, I think that's all we've got time for today. So I'd like to say a big thank you to Professor Pelihungin for joining us to discuss functional GI disorders with a focus on irritable bowel syndrome. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this RCGP podcast, then please listen to others on a variety of subjects.